Chapter 5 Boundary Layers. As we saw in Chapter 2, the viscosity of a fluid produces fluid stresses in response to shear. In flows with high Reynolds numbers, shear rates can become large, with velocities changing substantially over small distances, thereby creating considerable stresses. A historically important discovery at the turn of the 20th century found that these large shear rates, occurring in regions called boundary layers, are not governed by geometry, but instead occur spontaneously due to the physics of the moving fluid. To understand boundary layers, we have to go back in time to the world of fluid dynamics prior to their discovery and examine the subtle role played by viscosity when the Reynolds number is very large. Drag and the limit of high Reynolds numbers. One of the main issues in the application of fluid mechanics to industry is the prediction of drag. Suppose a body moves through a fluid, for example an aeroplane through hot air or a submarine in the ocean. The drag is the magnitude of the force resisting the motion and acting in the direction opposite to the body's motion. Drag is important to industry because it is ultimately what governs economic cost. A significant portion of the airfare on your next plane ticket goes to the fuel needed to power the aeroplane against the air drag. A fundamental question is therefore, what is the value of the drag? It is clear that it depends on the Reynolds number, and in many situations relevant to industry, that number is large. In fact, it is exceedingly large. The Reynolds number of the airflow around a commercial aeroplane is in excess of tens of millions, while around a moving submarine it can be hundreds of millions. In the 19th century, computers were not available to help solve the complicated equations of fluid mechanics, and therefore scientists interested in estimating drag at high Reynolds numbers had to think. They came up with the following simple argument. Since the Reynolds number scales as the inverse of the viscosity, the large Reynolds number limit corresponds to a situation where viscosity plays a relatively small role in affecting the fluid motion. If that is the case, then surely the result for the flow must not be very different from that obtained by ignoring viscosity altogether. So scientists made the radical assumption to take the viscosity to be exactly zero. This is equivalent to saying that the Reynolds number is exactly infinite. Perfect fluids. A fluid with zero viscosity is called a perfect fluid. If we get rid of viscosity completely, one term drops out of the Navier-Stokes equations governing the fluid motion, the second to last term in equation 3. In that case, they become the Euler equations, named after Leonhard Euler. The Euler equations are still very complicated, but under a wide range of assumptions, they can actually be solved exactly, and hence drag can be computed. To solve the Euler equations, we have to assume the fluid flow has no swirling motion. Using the terminology that will be introduced in Chapter 6, this is saying that the fluid has no vorticity. This is an assumption that turns out to be mostly adequate for flows away from any rigid surface. In that case, the solution of the equation is due to another 18th century Swiss mathematician, Daniel Bernoulli. Born into a family of renowned mathematicians, Bernoulli showed how to calculate the value of the pressure in the fluid explicitly. His challenging solution requires the use of a mathematical toolbox called vector calculus. We can, however, derive a simplified version of it by only relying on the principle of conservation of energy in the fluid. For example, consider the case of a cylindrical jet of fluid flowing at high Reynolds numbers and undergoing a change in its cross-section. We ignore all effects due to gravity and assume that the flow is steady, that is, not changing in time. The geometry is illustrated in Figure 24. Upstream in the jet of cross-sectional area, capital S sub 1, the mean fluid speed is denoted by capital U sub 1, and the pressure by P sub 1. Downstream, where the area is now capital S sub 2, the speed and pressure are, respectively, capital U sub 2 and P sub 2. The flow is incompressible, so the constant flow rate capital Q in the jet is given by capital Q is equal to capital S sub 1, capital U sub 1 is equal to capital S sub 2, capital U sub 2. Because the two speeds are different, the kinetic energy of the fluid changes between the upstream and downstream locations. The principle of conservation of energy in the fluid states that the changes in kinetic energy of the fluid are due to the work done by the pressure forces on the fluid. The kinetic energy of a mass, capital M, of fluid is, open parenthesis, half, close parenthesis, capital M, capital U squared. Since capital Q, capital T is the volume of fluid going through the surface during the time capital T, the amount of kinetic energy passing through any cross-section during that time is given by, open parenthesis, half, close parenthesis, rho, capital U squared, capital Q, capital T. The force capital F exerted on the fluid due to the pressure is given by pressure times surface area. Capital F is equal to P capital S. When a force is exerted on a body moving a distance capital L, the work done by the force is equal to capital F capital L. In this case, during the time capital T the fluid moves a length, capital L is equal to capital U capital T, so the work done on the fluid by the pressure is equal to capital F capital L is equal to capital F capital U capital T is equal to P capital S capital U capital T, which is equal to P capital Q capital T. Conservation of energy is therefore written as equation 19, or, after dividing by capital Q capital T, equation 20. The result in equation 20, known as Bernoulli's equation, shows that the quantity P plus rho capital U squared divided by 2 remains constant in the fluid. The same equation is obtained when solving the Euler equations directly. The physical intuition behind this result is that if P sub 1 is greater than P sub 2, then the upstream pressure pushes on the fluid more, and therefore the fluid accelerates, resulting in capital U sub 2 is greater than capital U sub 1. D'Alembert's paradox. Bernoulli's equation shows that, provided that the quantity P plus rho capital U squared divided by 2 is known somewhere in the fluid, and it is usually the case far from any disturbances, then wherever the speed of the fluid is known, so is the pressure, and therefore the drag on a rigid body can be evaluated. An early calculation of the drag was successfully carried out by the French mathematician Jean-Laurent d'Alembert, famous for having edited the scientific portion of Diderot's multi-volume 18th-century encyclopedia. The result from d'Alembert is both simple and profound. He showed that the drag on a rigid body moving at constant speed in a perfect fluid is always zero, so there is no drag whatsoever. This result is so surprising and so counterintuitive to our daily life that it is now known as d'Alembert's paradox. Demonstrating this result rigorously is quite intricate mathematically, but we can gain the correct intuition by considering the flow of a perfect fluid past a spherical body. Consider a sphere moving with steady speed through a perfect fluid. Moving with the sphere, we see that it experiences an incoming flow, and we illustrate its streamlines, that is, the lines of flow in figure 25a. Here again we assume that the fluid has no swirling motion. To calculate the drag, we need to know the traction on the surface of the sphere, that is, the force per area exerted by the moving fluid. Since the fluid is perfect, its viscosity is zero, and therefore from chapter 2, we know that the only traction is a normal stress due to pressure. Bernoulli's equation states that the quantity P plus rho, capital U squared divided by 2, is constant everywhere in the flow. So with the knowledge of capital U, we can now obtain P and deduce the drag. The key feature of the flow shown in figure 25b is its perfect front-back symmetry. Specifically, the magnitude of the flow speed somewhere near the sphere in front of it is exactly the same as the symmetric point behind the sphere. Consider two points, capital M and capital N, front-back symmetric to one another, as shown in the figure. The fluid speeds at capital M and capital N are the same. So, following Bernoulli, we see that the pressures at these two points are also identical. At each point, the pressure exerts a stress that pushes against the sphere along the direction normal to the sphere. By symmetry, we therefore see that the magnitude of the traction along the direction of motion at point capital M is equal and opposite to that at point capital N. But for every point on the side of the sphere, we can find a symmetric point on the other side. So for every traction, there is an equal and opposite traction on the other side as well. The total drag force on the sphere, which is the sum of all tractions, can therefore only be zero. If the speed of the sphere is not constant, but instead the body accelerates or decelerates, the fluid around it would have to also be accelerated or decelerated, which would result in a drag force, and the Bernoulli equation would have additional terms. But in the simple case where the body moves with a constant speed, the force agrees with D'Alembert's prediction of zero drag. Clearly this result is at odds with our everyday experience. Zero drag would mean no resistance from the surrounding air when we ride our bikes, and no friction from the water when we swim in the pool. So what could have gone wrong? The problem turns out to hinge on the way the large Reynolds number limit was taken. Even for Reynolds numbers as large as can be imagined, the effects of viscosity somehow still matter. This is best illustrated in Figure 25, where we show experiments for the flow at high Reynolds numbers past a sphere, and see that the fluid motion in the experiment is markedly different from the idealized perfect fluid result. Why is it, then, that the mathematical case of zero viscosity is qualitatively different from that of a very large Reynolds number? A revolution. Boundary layers. In order to solve D'Alembert's paradox, a new way to find the approximate solutions of equations containing a very small parameter, the viscosity, had to be invented. The answer was a revolution, perhaps the biggest in the field of fluid mechanics, that came in a celebrated 1904 paper by the German engineer Ludwig Prandtl. Prandtl invented the concept of boundary layers. He explained how they appear in the fluid when the Reynolds number becomes very large, and how much drag they produce. As for many things in fluid mechanics, multiple ways to think about the intuition behind boundary layers exist. From a physical point of view, since the viscosity is responsible for shear stresses, assuming a vanishing viscosity means that one removes the source of friction in the fluid. However, that microscopic friction is responsible for enforcing the no-slip boundary condition on solid boundaries. Remove viscosity, and you remove the origin of the no-slip condition, so the fluid will be allowed to slip on the surface of the body. A close inspection of the flow in Figure 25a does reveal slip occurring on the sphere surface. So from a physical standpoint, assuming a fluid to be perfect removes a crucial feature of fluid flow, its ability to enforce the correct, no-slip boundary condition on rigid surfaces. It might be true that viscosity is not very important in most of the moving fluid, but near the surface of the body it matters tremendously. Aside from the physics, an alternative mathematical explanation exists for the failure of the perfect fluid approximation. The Navier-Stokes equations satisfied by the fluid velocity and pressure are given in equation 3. We do not analyse them in detail, but one aspect is important. These are called differential equations because they involve the spatial and temporal derivatives of our unknowns, specifically of second order, since they include two spatial derivatives of the fluid velocity. It is broadly known in mathematics that if one solves a differential equation with n derivatives, then one needs n boundary conditions for the problem to be well posed. So to solve the second-order Navier-Stokes equations in the setup of Figure 25, we need two boundary conditions. One sets the speed of the fluid far from the body, and the other is the no-slip condition on the body itself. Now if instead we assume the fluid to be perfect, the viscosity disappears, and with it the term involving two spatial derivatives. We are then left with the first-order Euler equations involving a single spatial derivative and thus only enforcing a single boundary condition. We can match the correct flow at infinity, but not the no-slip condition. This is the mathematical signature of the loss of friction discussed earlier. In his landmark 1904 paper, which more than 100 years later is still the way we understand flows, Prandtl demonstrated that even in the limit of exceedingly higher Reynolds numbers, the viscosity always matters. However, the effect of viscosity is confined to thin boundary layers near rigid surfaces. Outside these regions, the flow behaves, to a very good approximation, like a perfect fluid. Inside the boundary layer, things are very different, and the flow has to be brought down quickly to zero on the surface to satisfy the no-slip condition. The size of a boundary layer. One of the most important features of boundary layers is that they become thinner when the Reynolds number increases and can, in fact, quickly become much smaller than the body to which they are attached. For example, the boundary layer on an aeroplane wing at cruising speed can be smaller than a millimetre. To understand why this is so, we can consider the very simple case of a thin plate in a flow of speed, capital U. We denote by capital L the length of the plate and by capital W its width, and can use a physical argument to estimate the thickness of the boundary layer, denoted by delta. Newton's second law states that the rate at which momentum is lost by the incoming fluid is equal to the force resulting from the viscous stresses, all of which are concentrated in the boundary layer. The momentum in the boundary layer is on the order of capital M, capital U, where the mass, capital M, of the fluid in the boundary layer is capital M is similar to rho, capital V, for a fluid volume of approximately capital V is similar to delta, capital L, capital W. So the momentum in the boundary layer has magnitude rho, delta, capital L, capital W, capital U. Driven by the flow at speed, capital U, changes in the boundary layer along the plate occur on the flow timescale. Capital T is similar to capital L divided by capital U. So the rate at which the momentum is changing in the boundary layer is given by the ratio open parenthesis rho delta capital L capital W capital U close parenthesis divided by capital T is similar to rho delta capital W capital U squared. Inside the boundary layer, the viscous shear stress, sigma, has a magnitude predicted by Newton's law of viscosity, equation 2, as sigma is similar to mu capital U divided by delta, where delta is the thickness of the boundary layer, and therefore approximately the length scale across which the flow near the plate changes from 0 to capital U. In other words, the shear rate in the boundary layer is approximately capital U divided by delta. Since a shear stress is a force per unit of surface area, the total viscous force exerted by the plate on the fluid has magnitude capital F is similar to sigma capital L capital W is similar to mu capital L capital W capital U divided by delta. With this, we can directly apply Newton's second law and balance the rate at which momentum is lost by the total viscous force, so that we see equation 21, which leads to an explicit estimate for the boundary layer size as seen in equation 22. We recognise on the right-hand side of this estimate the inverse of the Reynolds number for the flow past the plate, and therefore we can write the size of the boundary layer as equation 23. This famous inverse square root scaling shows that for large Reynolds numbers, the boundary layer is much thinner than the size of the plate. Delta is much smaller than capital L. The fluid speeds near the plate therefore undergo changes over very small distances, which leads to considerable shear stresses and drag. Flow separation and wake. In the boundary layer discussion, we did not mention the flow pressure. The reason is that the pressure inside the boundary layer is always inherited from the pressure outside it. In the case of a flat plate, the flow outside the boundary layer has constant speed and constant pressure, so there is no pressure gradient there, and thus also no gradient inside the boundary layer. However, in flows around more complex shapes, the flows outside the boundary layer usually have gradients in pressure, which in turn affect the features of the flow inside the boundary layer. A prototypical shape that is not elongated in the flow direction is called a bluff body, for example a sphere, or a non-streamlined human being. In that case, the fluid dynamics inside the boundary layer becomes very subtle. The flow momentum changes not only because of viscous stresses, but also because of the pressures inherited from the outside flow. When the changes in pressure along the body are such that, on their own, they would induce fluid motion in the same direction as the actual flow, that is, when the pressure decreases in the direction of the flow, similarly to the pipe flow of Chapter 3, we call them favourable. In contrast, when they push the other way, we referred to them as adverse. A favourable pressure gradient would be like blowing air with the wind, while an adverse one like blowing against the wind. Complications arise every time an adverse pressure gradient exists in a boundary layer, near the leading edge of the body, that is, the tip of the body upstream of the flow. The boundary layer is thin, it remains along the body and the pressure gradient is favourable. If the pressure gradient stays favourable all along, then the boundary layer stays attached to the body. However, if at some point the pressure gradient becomes adverse, it will slow down the flow in the boundary layer. In fact, if it is sufficiently adverse for a long time, the flow comes to a halt and the boundary layer completely detaches from the body. This phenomenon whereby a boundary layer stops and leaves the body is called flow separation. We illustrate it in Figure 27 in the case of a flow past a tilted wing. The flow beneath the wing has not separated, and the boundary layer there remains attached throughout. In contrast, the flow above the wing separates very quickly, and after the separation point, we see a wake of vortices. Separation can also be observed in Figure 25b for flow past a sphere at about the halfway point along the surface of the body. Body shapes with little flow separation or none at all are called streamlined, with examples including many marine animals such as rays, eels and most other fish. In industry, a century of aircraft design has produced wings whose shapes are streamlined, in an incoming flow aligned with the wing. We illustrated this in Figure 28, where numerical simulations of the flow past an Airbus A380 show the streamlines past the wing, that is, the path of fluid particles, the levels of grey on the body of the plane as the pressure field. Although the flow occurs at very high Reynolds numbers, the streamlines remain attached to the wing on their entire span. If separation were to occur, the appearance of the wake would be associated with a steep increase in the drag acting on the body. In some cases, this drag is beneficial. For example, aeroplane wings have flaps called spoilers that are lifted up immediately upon landing to induce separation and help slow down the plane. Laminar versus turbulent boundary layers. In chapters 3 and 4, we saw how the Reynolds number controls the transition from laminar to turbulent flows. The same transition can also take place inside a boundary layer, resulting in even steeper shears and higher local drag. However, when the boundary layer becomes turbulent, the vigorous motion happening inside it delays flow separation. So an interesting compromise arises when it comes to drag at high Reynolds numbers. When the boundary layer flow becomes turbulent, the component of the drag due to the boundary layer goes up, but separation is delayed, so the wake drag goes down. In some cases, inducing a transition to turbulent flow inside the boundary can in fact lead to a decrease of the overall drag, a phenomenon known as the drag crisis. The drag crisis is illustrated in Figure 29 for the flow at speed capital U past a rigid sphere, whose surface is smooth, dark solid line. We plot the dimensionless drag on the sphere, that is, the total hydrodynamic force divided by a term with the same dimensions, namely, rho, pi, open parenthesis, capital U, capital D, close parenthesis, squared, divided by 8, where capital D is the diameter of the sphere, as a function of Reynolds number. Reynolds is equal to rho, capital U, capital D, divided by mu. At higher Reynolds numbers, the dimensionless drag is approximately constant until it suddenly decreases at a critical Reynolds number. The drag crisis results from the transition to turbulence in the boundary layer and the delay of the separation. If instead of being smooth, the surface of the sphere is rough, the drag crisis occurs at a lower value of the Reynolds number, and it is less pronounced. The effect of roughness is to encourage the transition to turbulence to take place earlier, a useful feature in all applications where one wants to decrease drag. For example, small dimples on the surface of golf balls induce the drag crisis, thereby decreasing drag and allowing players to reach long distances. Other boundary layer control mechanisms developed in industry actively modulate drag, in particular on aircraft.